Turn in your Bible, please, to Isaiah 29. Isaiah 29. We remind the deacons after the service tonight, we'll have our monthly meeting. And so hopefully we'll be done on time. And we'll have our meeting and we'll talk about some of the things that's been happening as far as money we've been spending. And we've spent some recently. But aren't you comfortable? Had to get the air conditioners fixed. So anyway, deacons, don't forget about that tonight. Isaiah 29, that will be our text. But before we get there, let me just say this. The title of the message is The Hypocrisy of God's People. The Hypocrisy of God's People. You know, as a young teenage Christian, one of the things that always weighed on my mind is you might not always be right and you might not always be in fellowship, but don't be a hypocrite. And I guess that I thought those thoughts as an immature baby Christian, because I had begun reading my Bible immediately after I got saved, and one of the things that Jesus was constantly condemning was the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. And I used to think, you know, I don't want to be a hypocrite. I want to be somebody that is genuine, somebody that is as transparent as is humanly possible. And I've tried to live my Christian life that way. But I do know that there are many, many people that have named the name of Christ that really have been hypocritical in the way that they have conducted themselves. The people of Israel were just like Christians today. They had the same sin nature that we have today, and we have the same one that they had 2,700 years ago. That's the time frame in which we're going to be looking at tonight. And so when you have Isaiah, this great old prophet, and what is he doing? He is preaching, and you have in this portion of Isaiah, from chapter 28 through about chapter 33, you have six woes that he gives. I've often wondered when Jesus preached that famous message in Matthew 23, which was the last and most scathing of all of his sermons, I've often wondered the number of times that he used woe. Was that something that he decided to use because Isaiah had used that? I don't know. We'll have to ask Jesus when we get to heaven. But I know this. I know that woe is a strong word. It is a word that has the idea that judgment will come and you need to get ready for it because it's coming whether you want it or not. That's the idea that you have. Now, if you're taking notes and you want to write these six woes down, I will give you the addresses so that you can read those later. Woe number one, it's found in Isaiah 28. The whole chapter, it has to do with basically the area or the people called Ephraim. If you don't know who Ephraim was, that was one of the children of Joseph. Ephraim and the people of Ephraim did not always live for God, and they would be conquered. And there is a woe that is pronounced on them in chapter 28. The one that we're going to look at tonight is in chapter 29, verses 1 through 14. Now we're going to come back to that passage in a moment. Woe number 3 is in chapter 29, 15 through 24. That has to do with nations that are trying to work in darkness. They're trying to hide their works from God. And of course, you can't hide anything from God. Woe number 4 is found in chapter 30, verses 1 through 5. And this is the woe that Isaiah pronounces upon the city of Jerusalem because of their foreign alliances. In other words, God told them not to have these alliances, but yet in their own wisdom, they decided this is what we will do. And so because of that, The prophet Isaiah pronounced a woe upon them. The fifth woe is also found in chapter 30, and that goes from verse 6 through verse 33. And this has the idea that that Jerusalem should not have had an alliance with a singular nation of Egypt. Whenever you read about Egypt in the Bible, it always talks about, and so-and-so went down to Egypt. Like Abraham was going to go to Egypt, and God said no. Isaac was going to go, and God stopped him. You have, really, as far as I know, about the only positive time that anybody ever went to Egypt was when Joseph and Mary went to get away from Herod the Great, when he was trying to kill all the babies of Bethlehem. And so I don't know of any other positive, I'm not saying there's not any, I just don't remember any. And so you've got this alliance that they made for the fifth woe with the nation of Egypt. And then the sixth and final woe of Isaiah is found in chapter 33, verses 1 through 9. And this is not really a woe that is toward Judah or Jerusalem. This is a woe that is directed toward Assyria. Now, we're going to look a little bit at Assyria, and we're going to see Assyria's hand in what is about to take place. We're also going to look at a passage of Scripture and see how that God is going to crush Assyria, or at least one of their kings. And so those are the woes, but the focus of tonight, for the next few minutes, is the second one. I want you to look with me at chapter 29, beginning in verse number 1. And we're going to look, first of all, at the woe that's declared. There is a woe that is declared by the great prophet. It says, woe to Ariel. Now, what is Ariel? Well, that is a reference to the city of Jerusalem. You say, well, how do you know that? Well, it's not that big of a leap. The city where David dwelt. I mean, if it's the place where David lived. David had a palace that was there. He would wonder in his mind, how come I have a house, but God doesn't have a house? And the truth of the matter is, God didn't really care for a house, but he went ahead and let Solomon build it. He let David collect the materials for it. But God didn't really need a house, but David wanted to do something, and so there was a temple that was constructed by Solomon. And so you've got Ariel, which is Jerusalem, and it says, add ye year to year. That is a sarcastic term that has the idea of just keep doing it. Keep on. Yeah, go ahead. And what are they doing? Said, let them kill sacrifices. In other words, let them continuing on all of these various festival days. And there are many, many festivals during the calendar year in Judaism. We all know about the Passover, but there are many other festivals. There is sacrifices that were constantly being made. And you have God, and he's telling them through the prophet, he says, yeah, add year to year. Let them kill the sacrifices. And what is God going to do? Verse number 2. He says, yet I will distress Ariel, and there shall be heaviness and sorrow, and it shall be unto me as Ariel. In other words, when the sorrow and the distress would come upon the people, this is the way that God is going to feel about it, but yet he is going to allow this to come. It is going to be a place of slaughter. You say, well, why do you think God is going to do that? He's going to do it because the sins of the people. Now, when the people of God are hypocrites, that is not something that God looks lightly upon. And I don't think that the same God that was in 700 BC at this time, it looks upon it any different in 2025. I believe that he expects his people to be honest people. He expects his people to be people of integrity. He expects us to be people that have character, people that are genuine in our commitment, genuine in our hearts. Instead of just telling people how committed we are, we can show them how committed we are. Instead of just speaking about our love for God, we show them our love for God. Instead of just talking about how faithful we are, we show our faithfulness to God, not just publicly, but I think even so privately. One of the great criticisms that I used to hear teenagers back when I dealt with them eons ago, some of them would talk about the people that they knew, sometimes even their own moms and dads. And they would talk about how they were one way at church and they would be another way at home. That does not make for a good testimony. Your kids ought to look at you at church and look at you at home and say, they're the same. That ought to be the attitude that we have going in. Now, that doesn't mean that you wear a tie at home if you're behind the pulpit on Sundays. If you were to come to my house, you might find me in a pair of overalls. But I wear a tie, but I want my behavior in front of my kids and my grandkids to be something that is consistent with what is portrayed when I stand behind this pulpit. I want them to be where that they can look and go, well, my dad's the same. My dad's not hypocritical. If you begin to have somebody that is full of hypocrisy, the next thing you know, there's a contemptuousness that begins to grow. And so you've got these people and their hypocrisy is on display. Look with me at verse 13. Wherefore the Lord said, for as much as this people draw near to me with their mouths, and with their lips they do honor me, but have removed their heart far from me, and their fear toward me is taught by the precept of men. In other words, they say one thing, but their heart is somewhere else. And that is a dangerous, dangerous place for God's people to be. I believe that whenever they hear Isaiah saying this, they're not listening. And we're going to see something at the third point where that they are deluded about some things. And so as I'm looking at this, I see that they are offering these sacrifices just like everything is hunky-dory. They're offering these sacrifices year after year after year. And God's saying, go ahead and do it. But I got news for you, Ariel. Judgment is coming. You say, why do you believe that? Well, the name Ariel in the Hebrew, it means the Lion of God. But there's a second meaning. It has the idea of the altar of burnt sacrifice. And so God says, yet will I distress Ariel. So what does that mean? That means that he is going to distress them and they're going to be the offering that's on that altar themselves. Now, these people, they should have seen this. If you begin to look and you see in verse number 3, it says that I will camp against thee round about and will lay siege against thee with a mount. That literally happened before their eyes. How did it happen? Well, if you go back in history of the Old Testament, what you find is you find in 722 B.C., the Assyrian people had sent their armies against the northern tribes of Israel. You remember after Solomon, that nation split. 10 tribes went north, 2 tribes were in the south. It became known as Judah in the south, Israel in the north. And against Israel, all of those 10 tribes, the nation of Assyria had come in and one by one by one, every single one of those tribes had fallen. All of their little cities, all of their little towns, their villages, their little hamlets, all of that had been wiped out and they were now under Assyrian control. But it did not just stop there. As it continued, they were coming south. They didn't see that line that said north and south. They conquered all of the north, and as they were doing that, they kept migrating toward the south, and they began to conquer everything in Judah until they got to Jerusalem. And once they hit Jerusalem, God said, that's it. You had King Hezekiah. And Hezekiah is ultimately, he's going to be dead by the time these woes are there. But Hezekiah, he knows that the Assyrians have taken the north. He knows that all around Jerusalem, they have taken most of what we know as Judea. They've taken that. And he cries out to God. And I want you to see how God saves Jerusalem. I want you to flip forward in Isaiah to go to chapter 37. Isaiah 37, and I want you to look with me at, I think it's verse 36. I was looking at 37, 36. Yeah, okay. Well, let's just start in verse 34. By the way that he came, that's a man named Sennacherib. If you don't know how to remember him, just think sack of ribs, all right? You've got Sennacherib, that was the king of Assyria, and by the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city. In other words, God is saying he is not going to take Jerusalem. And the king is thinking, well, he's taken everything else. How come he's not going to take us? Earlier in Isaiah, he talked about laying siege. Well, it says, for I, God is speaking, will defend this city to save it for mine own sake and for my servant David's sake. Now, this is how God did it. The people of Jerusalem, they had no hope. They had no soldiers. They had no army. They had no weapons except God Almighty that could do what is about to be done. Then the angel of the Lord, one angel. It's not angels of the Lord. The angel of the Lord. This could be the Lord Jesus Christ. One of the theological terms that you will hear from time to time is a theophany or a Christophany. And that is an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. And so you've got this angel of the Lord, which could be Christ, but if it's not Christ, it's certainly a powerful angel from the Lord, went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000, that is 185,000 Assyrian soldiers. One angel. Now, can I tell you that one angel that kills 185,000 trained soldiers is a bad motor scooter? He is bad. And yet, that is exactly what happened. And it says, and when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. 185,000 dead bodies that are in tents and around campfires that are now smoldering ashes. And it says, so Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed. What did he do? He went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. Why did he go to Nineveh? Because that was the capital city of Assyria. It's the same place that Jonah was told to go and preach. And the way that the Assyrians treated God's people in the north, Jonah goes, I don't want them to be saved. I don't want God to give them mercy. When you read about the atrocities of Assyria, when they would take people into captivity, they would put hooks in their jaws that would go up underneath their chin, come out through their mouth, and would be led away on ropes that would be connected to a main line. It would be likened unto a fisherman using a trot line. And they would have teams of oxen that would drag them. And if somebody fell out and died, instead of dragging them, they would just take their sword, cut the rope off, and leave the carcass there, like the Trail of Tears during the time when the Cherokee Indians had those thousands that died. They were a wicked people. They would take pregnant women and just cut their bellies open and have their babies fall out. They would take little children by the heels and swing them around and crush their skulls. You read those descriptions in the Word of God. And so Jonah goes, I'm not going. I want them to go to hell. That was his attitude. And God said, don't you realize that there are thousands and thousands and they don't even know their right hand from their left hand? They need to hear. And it took him an experience in the bottom of the ocean, probably even dying. I think Jonah probably died. And then he was resurrected, and then he was belched out upon on the shore. His body was probably bleached out from all of the acids that would have been in the fish's belly. But he went and did what God told him to do, even though he still didn't want to do it. You read Jonah chapter 4, and he's sad. He said, I shouldn't even have come. But yet he did it because he didn't want to have another fish experience. But the Assyrians were wicked people. And yet here you've got one angel. Now, this is happening about 20 years after that Assyrian army came in and wiped out the north. This is about 20 years later. And so you see that there is this woe that is there, and God is going to use them. Well, if you keep reading in chapter 37, it says, and it came to pass. It does not mean that it was the next day or the next day, but in a few days, as he, that is Sennacherib, was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Sharezer, his sons, smote him with a sword. They killed their own father. In other words, he had embarrassed them because he had been wiped out so much, and 185,000 soldiers have died in one night. And so they said, we can't let our father live, and so they killed their own daddy. That's rough. And yet that's exactly what they did. And when they kill him, they flee and they go into another country, and then he's got another son that reigns in his place. That son is going to come again in the form of his father, but ultimately Assyria will not be the one that takes Jerusalem. After Sennacherib dies, there'll be some years that'll pass. And when you go from 701, which is when that siege took place, and you fast forward to about 605 BC, which is not quite 100 years. If I'm doing my math right, that's about 97 years. That's the first time that the Babylonians come, and God is going to use them to come against his people. Why? Because they would not repent of their sins. Now, Hezekiah was a good king for the most part. He wasn't perfect by a million miles, but he was better than most. But when he died, all of a sudden, Ahaz began to go in a wrong direction. Manasseh, wrong direction. And you just keep going, 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 and finally God is filled up. And he says, that's it. And so we see that you have this group of people. Now go back to our passage in chapter 29, verse number 4. And thou shalt be brought down and shalt speak out of the ground. That's a significant phrase right there. Thy speech shall be low out of the dust. That's another way of saying out of the ground. And thy voice shall be as one that hath a familiar spirit out of the ground. And thy speech shall whisper out of the dust. Now, why does Isaiah use out of the ground, out of the dust, out of the ground, out of the dust? Why does he use that very type of phrase that is really a synonym of each other four times? He's driving this point home that the way that you're going to be brought down, it's going to be as though you're worshiping a demonic spirit. When you see that phrase, familiar spirit, there are several types of what we would call soothsayers in the Bible. If you want a kind of a definition about whenever you're reading and what they're doing, a soothsayer is someone that practices what we would call divination. That has the idea that they're trying to basically tell a fortune. Sometimes they would look at the clouds, and they would see the way that the clouds were forming. And I don't know if you ever did this as a kid, but I remember one of the things that my mom would do as we were on a trip. She would say, "Hey, let's look at the clouds and see if we can see something." Anybody ever play those games? That looks like the Michelin Man. That looks like a dog. That looks like Santa Claus in a sleigh. And you can have all these different things that you can visualize. Well, that's what someone that was a soothsayer would do. They would do all of these types of divinations where they would look at the clouds. Well, one of the things that they would have would be something that was called an enchanter. We know that there are terms or people that call themselves enchanters even today. And this has the idea of one who whispers a formula. If you ever watch any kind of movie or a television program and they're having somebody doing some kind of a seance, they kind of play off of this. And they'll be whispering formulas. That's one of the reasons I think that when we are learning to pray, that we learn not to be ritualistic. We don't just say vain repetition over and over again. And so you've got the enchanters, the wizards. That's another term that's used biblically. The Talmud says that a wizard was a man that would take a bone of an animal, bone of a dead animal, and he would put it in his mouth, and that bone would speak. That's the way that the Jewish Talmud would read it. But the one that we have here is a familiar spirit. This has the idea of what is called necromancy. The idea of conjuring. And so where does that conjuring come from? It comes out of the ground. And so that's why it says, we'll speak out of the ground, lo, out of the dust. That's why those terms are used there, because that familiar spirit has the idea of conjuring up from the ground and consulting with the dead. This goes all the way back, really, to Samuel. We know about Samuel, the great prophet, and how that he died. And Saul, what did he do? He went to a witch at Endor who was a necromancer. And what did she do? She conjured the dead spirit of Samuel. And so you have that familiar spirit that is there. Now look at verse number 6. "And thou shalt be visited." The word "visited" there doesn't mean that the preacher is going to knock on your door and say, "Just want to come by and see you." That's not the type of visit that we're talking about here. The type of visit that we're talking about here is you're fixing to be punished. It is a punishment. And it says, "Thou shalt be visited," or "thou shalt be punished of the Lord of hosts." And how is that punishment going to come? It's going to come with thunder, with earthquake, great noise, with storm and tempest, and flame of devouring fire. When the Babylonians came in, you can see that in figures of speech, how that great army would be able to accomplish each one of those. The noise, there's the thunder, there's the earthquake. Now, just imagine, you've got 100, 200,000 men that are walking. You can feel it. Years ago, when I was in college, we were playing football, and we had about maybe 40 guys on our team. I mean, we played both ways. I mean, there wasn't, you know, where you played offense or you played defense or you were on special teams. You did all of it. If you had any halfway ability, you played offense, defense, and special teams. We played a team in Marion, Alabama. And they come walking out from the top of the hill, and we're already down on the ground, and you can feel the ground moving. There was like 120 strong up there, and they're coming down, and you can just feel it. And old buddy Thinkpin looked at me, and he said, "We in trouble." And I said, "You're exactly right." And do you know what? They beat us 56-14. To this day, I don't know how we scored 14 points. And I think they finally let up on us. They had one guy. If he ever turned the corner, there was nobody on our team that could catch him. He was just gone. He ran back two kickoffs. He ran back two punts. And then he ran two touchdowns in just for the fun of it from the backfield. It was nuts. I mean, we had no chance. But when they came walking down, you could just feel the ground. Now, you imagine if you got a couple of 100,000 that are coming that way. You know, it was said about the Assyrians that angel killed. It said that old Sennacherib would dress them in red tunics, and it looked as though when they were coming across those hills, it looked like a red tidal wave was coming at the people, and it would put the fear of God in them. I'm sure Babylon had something that was the same. Maybe they had drums that were beating. Maybe they had horns that were blaring. But I know this. I know that every one of those descriptions, whether it's thunder, earthquake, noise, storm, tempest, or a devouring fire, every one of those things can be seen in wartime. And I think that that's probably what this is a reference to here. You say, when did that happen? Well, it was three times that Babylon came against Jerusalem. The first time was in 605, the second time was in 597, and the third time was in 586, all BC. And so we see that the woe is declared. Now quickly, I want you to think about the woe that's described. Look at verse 7. "And the multitude of all nations that fight against Ariel." What is Ariel? That's Jerusalem. "Even all that fight against her and her munition," that's her armaments, "and that distress her, shall he dream a dream as of a night vision." Now verse 8. "It shall even be as when a hungry man dreameth, and behold, he eateth, but he awaketh, and his soul is empty. And as a thirsty man dreameth, and behold, he drinketh, but he is awaketh, and behold, he is faint, and his soul hath appetite. So shall the multitude of all the nations be that fight against Mount Zion." In other words, this army, this woe that is being described in verse 7 and 8, it's going to be where that they are unable to be satisfied. There is an insatiable thirst. There is an insatiable hunger. And what is that? To come against Ariel to destroy it. Now, I personally think that this is one of those passages that have to do with a near fulfillment and a far fulfillment. You say, "Now, preacher, what are you talking about by that?" When you're dealing with prophecy, sometimes you have a prophecy that is fulfilled in two different times. It may be a near time, and then there will be a later time when a complete fulfillment will be taking place. I think that's probably what we're looking at right here. Now, if you were a preterist, you would not believe that. If you believe that everything that was prophetic happened before 70 AD, then you would not hold to what I'm about to tell you. But I believe that this is a reference to Babylon coming against them. And it says it's going to be like a dream in a night. And it's going to be like a hungry man when he dreams and he wakes up and he's still hungry. When they came in 605, they came again in 597. And in 597, that was not enough. And so they came again in 586. And finally in 586, the devastation was so great, they had nothing else they could take. And so there was a thirst that could not be quenched. There was a hunger that could not be satiated. And so you see that it's like a man that wakes and drinks, and he wakes up and he still needs something else to drink. Kind of reminds me of a drunk. I heard something this week. It said that in Washington, D.C., there are three parties. There's the Republican Party, there's the Democrat Party, and there's the cocktail party. That's probably true. And so you've got these people, and they are never, ever satiated. But I want you to go to Zechariah 14. Go to Zechariah 14, and I want you to look with me at some verses there. Look at verse number 1, Zechariah 14, 1. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. Verse 2. For I will gather all nations. I'm pretty sure that's what the end of verse number 8 says. Now, if you're still holding in chapter 29, if you look at the latter part of verse number 8, it says, so shall the multitude of all the nations. So here it says, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem, Ariel, to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Verse 3, we'll read one more verse. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. You think back how he fought against the Assyrians in chapter 37 of Isaiah, when he sent one angel and 185,000 are wiped out in one evening. Now the Lord is going to go forth and he is going to fight for Jerusalem again. So when does this take place? Well, I think the first time it took place was when the Assyrians under Sennacherib had besieged it in 701. But I believe also that this is a prophecy of what will take place at the end of the tribulation period and what we know as the Battle of Armageddon. Yesterday, I went by and saw the preacher and took him a milkshake, and we were talking. And one of the things that I like to do is get him to tell stories because it gets his mind off of his troubles. And I said, preacher, what was that guy's name that used to talk about the Battle of Julie Gilead? And he started smiling, and I thought, okay, I've done good. He's smiling. Well, then he goes into the story. And he has a friend named Lamar Wheeler, and he's a good Bible teacher. And he said he had a buddy, and they were all sitting around. And this guy started speaking up, and he goes, Mar, why don't you tell us about that Battle of Julie Gilead? And Lamar looked at him, and he said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, you know, said, I've heard you talk about it, the Battle of Julie Gilead. And he said, are you talking about the Battle of Armageddon? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Tell us about that Battle of Armageddon. And he was calling it the Battle of Julie Gilead. Well, we laughed about that, and then I got him to tell him some more stories, and so it was a good visit. But that is what we're talking about. We're not talking about the Battle of Julie Gilead here. We're talking about in Isaiah, the Battle of Armageddon. And all of these nations are going to be surrounding Israel. Now, I don't know if they've already taken parts of Israel, but I know that Jerusalem will not fall at that point. And you read Revelation chapter 19, which we won't go to tonight. My time is about gone. But you read Revelation 19, and the Lord's going to come back on a white horse, the kind that the Lone Ranger rode, not Tonto. And he's going to speak, and out of his mouth goes a sharp two-edged sword, and that 185,000 Assyrians is going to be nothing compared to what happens at the Battle of Armageddon. The blood will be up to the horses' bridles. Now, I personally don't think that it's going to be that deep. I think there's going to be so much splatter that it gets that high up on those horses. And so whether you think it's that deep or you think like me that it's just splatter that's all over the place that's that high and not something that's just down low, that's fine. You believe whatever you want to about it. But I'm going to tell you something. There's going to be carnage everywhere. And those 185,000, that's going to be little league compared to what's going to happen on that day. And I think that that is the far prediction that we see here in 29, 7 and 8. Last thing, the woe is when it comes, it brings delusion. It brings delusion. I want you to look at verse number 10. For the Lord hath poured out upon your spirit of deep sleep. Closed your eyes. The prophets and your rulers, the seers, hath he covered. How many of you know that verse in Proverbs where it says, where there is no vision, the people perish? Most of you know that. Now, I've heard preachers my whole ministry say, bless God, you need to set some goals. You need to have a vision. And they turn that verse into a passage where that you're supposed to be like, some type of Zig Ziglar, some type of motivational speaker. That is not the interpretation of that verse. A prophet would give a vision, which was the direction of the Lord. Where there is no prophetic direction of the Lord, the people perish. That's the interpretation of that verse. And so here in our passage, it says that there's a deep sleep, and he has closed their eyes. Prophets, the rulers, the seers, hath he covered. In other words, he has closed them off so that they have nothing to say because they have no word from God. God has gone silent on them. Now, one of the things that we call that 400 years between the Old and the New Testament are the silent years, or the 400 silent years. Now, God was working behind the scenes, but you don't read about any prophets from Malachi until 400 years later when John the Baptist rolls in. You've got 400 years of no vision, of no word from God. And so here, God is saying, I'm going to close your eyes. I'm going to make sure that the prophets and the seers are covered. They are not going to have anything. And he goes on to say in verse number 11, he says this, and the vision of all is become unto you as the words of a book that is sealed, which men deliver to one that is learned. In other words, they take it to the educated man. And they say, read this, I pray thee. And he saith, I cannot, for it is sealed. In other words, I can't tell you what it says. There's a seal upon it. I cannot break that seal. Verse 12. And the book is delivered to him that is not learned, the uneducated, and saying, read this. And he said, I am not learned. I don't know how to read. So the educated and the uneducated, they do not have a clue. Now, why is that? Well, because there's nobody that's prophesying. Now, why did God do that? Well, tradition tells us that Isaiah was the prophet that they did not want to listen to, and because of that, they killed him. Now, in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 37, you don't have to go to it, but you can just write this down. One of the descriptions about those people in that hall of faith is that they were sawn asunder. In other words, they were sawn in half with a wood saw. Now, I don't believe that this is what happened. I think that they took a hollow log and put Isaiah in that log and cut him in half like a magician would make like he's doing his assistant. But there is folklore in Judaism, and they believe that as the people were coming against Isaiah, because of the preaching, that there was a cedar tree that opened up and swallowed him and hid him from the people, and Ahaz the king cut that tree down and had it sawn asunder, and they say that the prophet that was sawn was Isaiah. Now, do I believe that a cedar tree opened up? If the Bible had said it, I would. If tradition says it, I say no. But I do know that Hebrews 11 talks about being sawn asunder, and so it makes perfect sense to me for them to do somebody that way, because the machinations of men are evil continually. That's why in Fox's Book of Martyrs, you have people that were put on racks, you have people that were filleted, you have people that were tied with horses, their arm here to one horse, their arm here to another horse, both legs, and they were run off in different directions, ripping the limbs from them. Yeah, that's what people did. And so can I believe that they took Isaiah and did that? Yes. Now, Jeff Richards told Chad this morning, we don't have to worry about that. We don't have any trees big enough to stuff Brother Tommy in. Well, I appreciate that. I've lost 45 pounds, and yet what are they doing? Still besmirching my weight. But you've got Isaiah, and old Isaiah, he is preaching. And the people are deluded. Now, one final thing. Go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 11. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 11. I want you to see what God's going to do to those people in the last days. Those that have heard and heard and heard. And I've heard people say this. I've even had people tell me this. Well, I'm not going to get saved until after the rapture, and then I'm going to believe on Jesus, and I'm going to get saved like some of them tribulation people. But look what this verse says. And for this cause God shall send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie. The Greek word for a there can also be translated the, and there are people like Mark Cameron that believes that when it says that they should believe the lie, that that is a description of the Antichrist. In other words, they are going to believe what the Antichrist says, and instead of going, oh man, my brother, he was right, my sister, he was right, my mama, she was right, my daddy, he was right, they're going to go, no, the Antichrist is right. Those aliens took them people. That's what they're going to believe. And they will not get saved. They'll end up taking the mark of the beast. And their fate is sealed. And so, you've got the delusion that the people of Jerusalem had. And the next thing you know, Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians roll in and they squash them. They become trodden under the foot of the Gentiles. And it was that way until May 14th. 1948. In 1948, Israel flew their flag, the Star of David, for the first time since the Babylonians conquered them. And so, there's that delusion. And can I tell you that delusion is still there? Verse 14 tells us that the wise men shall perish. The prudent men shall be hid. In other words, there's going to come a time when there'll be no wise people talking at all. It reminds me of the times in which we live now. The nonsense that comes out of our governments. The nonsense that comes out of social media. You know, it's the same mindset that says that, you know, Coast Guard ought to go get Gilligan's Island's survivors. I told you about that about 2 weeks ago. During the heyday of Gilligan's Island, 2,500 people a week were writing to Coast Guard saying, go save those people. You say, surely not. Well, P.T. Barnum said nobody ever went broke underestimating the stupidity of the American people. P.T. Barnum was right. Let's stand. The hypocrisy of God's people. Let's not be hypocrites. Let's try to live on Monday like we live on Sunday. Let's make sure that our kids look at our lives and go, Daddy's consistent at home just like he is at church. Same, same, same.